Well, hello, thinkers. And I am so excited about this new podcast with Nick Liguori. We are going to be talking about something that I think everybody will be fascinated by. It's about the flood, Noah's flood. And the question is, did it happen? How did it happen? Where did it happen? And is there any record of it happening? Well, Nick, welcome to our Thinker podcast, Patterns of Evidence. And you have done an amazing job with two books. In this first one, are they both called Echoes of Ararat?
Yes. The second one we're going to call tentatively Echoes of Ararat, Volume 2. So Volume 1 covering North and South America, Volume 2 covering East Asia and the Pacific Islands.
The story of the flood is in Genesis chapters 6, 7, 8, and 9, I believe. If someone doesn't really know about it, Nick, you want to paraphrase a little bit about this flood story?
God decides to send a flood because it says that mankind had corrupted their ways. There was violence, and all mankind did was evil in the sight of God. And God told Noah, I'm going to wipe out the world with a flood. Prepare an ark. And here's how you need to build it. Prepare an ark for the salvation of yourself, your family, and for representatives of all animals. And of course, the flood came, and that's recorded in chapters 7 and 8 of Genesis. All life perished, was drowned, except for Noah and those with them, it says. Peter says 8 people survived. The world at that time perished. Noah and his family repopulated the earth after that.
They built a boat, a big boat called the Ark, and that's basically a narrative that some people have said, let's say that it's a fairy tale, and that it wouldn't have happened. But now, this is what's very, very interesting, very, very compelling, is what you found, Nick, and we're going to get into how in the world you found all this information, that it's a narrative that was a worldwide. Hundreds and hundreds of cultures have a testimony in their history of this flood.
Well, Tim, one thing that you've said over the years in your documentaries and elsewhere is that we have a historical faith, and I'm keenly aware of that. I came to Christ on a college campus that was very hostile to Christianity there at Colorado State University, and I had to be prepared to defend my faith. And so often these intellectual battles have to do with the book of Genesis, right? Because Genesis is foundational to worldview and the rest of the Bible. So I had studied many things as it relates to Genesis. And one thing that's huge in Genesis is the flood of Noah, that this world has been destroyed by a flood sent by God. Scripture devotes 4 chapters to it, Genesis 6 through 9. And there are many lines of evidence for this flood, but one of them is flood legends. And this idea that there are actually hundreds of tribes and nations all over the world with a memory of an oral tradition of such a flood that sounds just like Genesis. Matching it in both general outline and specific details like the forewarning, the divine judgment, the preparation of a great canoe, they call it, or sometimes the raft, that ark being lifted up by the floodwaters, all other life perishing, it landing on a high mountain after a while, the flood eventually going down, birds, that there were one or two birds and one bird returned with something in its beak as a sign that the flood was ending, and the subsequent repopulation of the world, sometimes the Tower of Babel, after that even a rainbow. I was studying many other things, but you know, one day this subject struck me in a new way. Cultures all over the world that know of this flood, this is powerful evidence and people need to know about this. And so I wanted to learn more about this. What is the state of the evidence? And I wanted to be able to share that with people. But as I began researching, I found that these hundreds of flood stories, I couldn't find them. I might find a Christian book with a few tribes here or there or secondhand information, but it was piecemeal. It was often poorly documented. And that was disappointing. You know, it was disappointing because I felt that as Christians, we were doing a disservice to the world by not documenting this powerful evidence. You know, there ought to be a book that we can share with unbelievers to let them know that this flood is real, that God's word is true, and we can trust it right from the very first page in Genesis. And in fact, some of the best books on the subject were written by unbelievers who didn't believe a word of the flood. And so I thought that was disappointing as well. We have some good stuff from Christian authors, but it's from mainly the 1800s, and it's difficult to access these days. And even that's kind of piecemeal. So, you know, I kept reading and I drilled down on first the Native Americans. You know, I love the Native Americans. fascinated by them. And so I just started reading, what do the Cherokee and the Iroquois tribes believe about the flood? And I would find tribe after tribe that they had an ancient tradition of this flood matching Genesis. The Arapaho, the Cheyenne, the Apache, the Ottawa, these tribes of Canada. And then I went down into Mexico and they knew about the flood as well. And I would just ask myself, what is the Genesis flood doing in the histories of these nations? It's not supposed to be there unless the Genesis flood is true. And I would find that in South America as well, the jungles of Brazil, from the Incans, the Guarani, and all these tribes of Argentina and so on. And before long, I realized that I had to write a book. I had never planned, Tim, to write a book, but, you know, three things. One, the gap in information that exists. Two, the importance of the subject and the vast amount of evidence I had found. And three, the false narratives that were prevailing about, you know, it's just a myth. I felt I had an obligation before God to write a book, and here we are.
Yeah, well, I'm telling you, when you get this book, and everybody needs to own this book, because this is such a great testimony. What you're doing is you're testifying to an event. And these stories, even though there's different variations, there's a consistency to them. The research that you went into, I mean, it's so well done. How did you start to tackle this? When you look at all the Native Americans, all of the different nations, it's like there's so many places we could talk about. But one of the, you know, first questions we had here was, how would you describe your research, how you started this research? What was the research process like as you're uncovering all these different flood narratives?
Well, first, I wanted to find good primary sources, right? Written by authors who were in a position to know what were the early beliefs and traditions of these tribes and these nations. And that could be a report from an anthropologist in the 1890s, or it could be an explorer in the early 1800s, or maybe a government official that wrote something in the 1800s, or a missionary, or even a native author, or a historian writing in the 1700s and early 1800s about the Americas. And so I want early, original, the earlier the better. And in fact, many of our sources go back even to the 1500s, and some of the evidences themselves predate Christ, very ancient. We have not only oral traditions, we have some that were written. From a practical standpoint, I will say I've certainly been helped by things like the digitalization of old books, and also interlibrary loan. I've had a great library that's helped me to locate rare books. Some of this information is in rare books across the country, even trying to track down books from out of the country. You know, I would say for volume two, one thing that was challenging was the language issue. Now, volume one, you have some Spanish, but it's mostly English, a little French. Volume two, we really ran into, you have to go into other language works to track down the original information, Russian, Chinese, even Japanese, Vietnamese. Other languages, Dutch. I've been very much helped, especially in volume two, by a co-author, Valdis Gauss, who is a linguist. He's actually an expert in Taiwan and the Taiwanese tribes and their traditions, probably the leading expert in the world on Taiwan's traditions. Because again, we have to go back to the original best sources. And if that be in Chinese, we got to do it. I would say also there was a level of quality assurance and screening that we had to do. When we talk about the risk of Christian influence on these traditions, because I want original traditions, right? I'm not interested in influenced traditions. I want, what did they believe in the ancient past? And so there are ways that we can get at that. It's pretty easy to tell. They'll often refer to Noah or to Mary or Jesus or the Holy Spirit. And that's one thing. We certainly don't want to see that. Second, we want to see native material, native beliefs, even their religion that's very much part of these traditions. That's a good indication of Aboriginal authentic information. Third, if we find a flood story, you know, it's got its own twist on it compared to Genesis. And then we find that same variation, that same twist in other tribes within a language family. So we have multiple confirmation. That is a good indication. For example, we may have a flood story with an earth diver element or a recovery of fire motif, and we'll find several of those. And so that gives a level of confirmation that, hey, other tribes agree and have the same tradition. And also we're looking for as many sources as possible. And again, early quality authors.
For people to look at the preponderance of information, of these stories, and the fact that they're all around the world. My family has suggested I haven't done an enormous amount of work in it, but that we have a part of our family that came from the Potawatomi tribe. In the first book, it's on page 106. And what happens then is that these flood stories were recorded because much of the native cultures were oral tradition, right? They were passing it down. They didn't have written languages. So when people that were in those areas, like a frontier trader named Thomas Anderson, met a Potawatomi chief who recounted the tribe's origin story containing a memory of the flood. And Anderson put it in his diary. So this would be potentially one of my distant relatives. So this is Anderson saying this. He says, I put up at the lodge of an old Indian chief named Nana Boijo, who gave the following account of the origin of his tribe in answer to my inquiry of the subject. And he says, I take my name, said he, from my original ancestors, who were the first living man and woman. They found themselves in a big canoe. All the animals were also in the same canoe, floating on thick water. After a while, the ancestors insisted that there must be something much more substantial beneath the water. To test it, they wanted the deer or some other animal to dive down and ascertain. None would venture on so perilous and uncertain an undertaking. At length, a beaver volunteered to make the effort and jumped overboard, plunging beneath the waters. After a long time, he arose to the surface almost dead without being able to relate any satisfactory. But the ancients still persisted, and they go on here, and eventually they find land, you know.
And it turns out that beaver is a distant memory of Noah's raven and dove. And we can find clear links between a beaver and the muskrat. Sometimes they'll name a duck. It actually is a distorted memory of the raven and dove of Noah.
And now the Dakota Sioux, I live not far from where some of the first missionaries came. In 1830 to 1862, the Minnesota State Senator, James W. Leonard, was the first person killed in the Dakota Uprising in 1862 during the Civil War. But he had spent a lot of time with the Dakotas, learning their language and customs and legends. And I think they were the Pond Brothers that were also in Minnesota. But once again, he wrote of a flood tradition that he heard from them in the 1850s. Same thing is true over not far. My family in Menominee or in the Wisconsin area. And once again, this flood story. And what you found is hundreds of these tribes, right, have these flood stories that all speak different languages.
Right.
How long have we known about the existence of flood traditions?
Well, we've known about this for a long time. And this isn't a new argument or a new premise I've come up with. This is an ancient argument that's well established. I'm just documenting it a bit more thoroughly and bringing it up to date. But this is ancient. It goes back more than 2,000 years ago. If I can read a quote from Josephus, almost 2,000 years ago, he says, now all the writers of barbarian histories make mention of this flood and of this ark, among whom is Brasus the Chaldean. And he goes on to list several of them. So he's saying to the Romans, look, this flood, it's our Jewish history, but it's also your history. This is ancient. So if you had read Josephus' Antiquities of the Jews, you knew about this. You knew about flood stories all over the world. If you had read various Greek classics, you had heard of Deucalion and the Greek flood story. Or if you had read Indian, the Mahabharata, you had heard of their flood story. Or if you had read the Icelandic creation story or the Welsh creation story, or maybe you'd encountered Berossus through reading Eusebius in the early Christian writings, or if you had read the early Spanish accounts of the colonization of Mexico and Colombia from the 1500s, or of Columbus and those with him landing in Cuba. We have testimony of the knowledge of the flood from Cuba before the year 1500. Or if you had read maybe French missionary accounts from the 1700s in Canada, or if you had read early reports of the Native Americans, you knew that this knowledge of the flood was pervasive. So it's been known for a long time. And in fact, for most of history, people just acknowledged the flood. There was a flood long ago. Now, maybe they didn't believe in the God of the Bible, but they acknowledged the flood at least. So what changed? Well, three things I would point to in the late 1700s and the early 1800s, the rise of uniformitarian geology, especially with Charles Lyell and his Principles of Geology. Of course, that undermined the importance of the flood as an explanatory event and replaced it with millions of years, slow and gradual processes. The second would be, of course, Darwin. Darwinian evolution does not mix well with the flood. And the third would be the discovery in 1872 of a Babylonian tablet with a flood narrative, that's when the argument arose that, well, we think the Genesis flood was borrowed from an earlier source. We have refuted that at length in this book. Genesis did not borrow from a Babylonian source. The Genesis flood account is the true original history. And when we look at these flood legends all around the world, they point back to Genesis and not the Babylonian version as the true one, the true original record of that event.
Because it's different, right? The Babylonian account is different than the Genesis account a little bit.
It differs in several ways. For example, the part about the birds in Genesis, Noah sends a raven and then a dove. And on the second trip, the dove returns with an olive leaf in its beak. A very different account of the birds in the Babylonian Epic of Gilgamesh. And can you guess which one native flood stories agree with? They always agree with Genesis and not the Babylonian version. Or why the flood was sent. Very different reason because of mankind's wickedness in Genesis. In the Babylonian version, it is because mankind was too noisy and the gods couldn't sleep. We could look at the shape of the floating vessel. In every single instance where the native versions from, whether it's North America, South America, China, Southeast Asia, the Pacific, Europe, Africa, they always agree with Genesis and not the Babylonian version.
What is the shape difference there? Is it much of a longer shape?
So in Genesis, God tells Noah to build it 300 cubits by 50 by 30, and it's very similar to the dimensions of a modern cruise ship. In the Epic of Gilgamesh, it is a cube, which is absurd from a stability in the water standpoint. And so in the tribal versions, it's always a shape that it's a canoe. It's something that's much longer than it is tall or wide.
Well, if you look at the secular scientists and historians, and let's just say that there has been certain people that wanted to throw off, in some ways, I think, the Bible, right? They wanted to throw off the narratives of the Bible because they didn't want to see the world through that lens. As you mentioned, with Darwin and these other ideas that came forward, what did you learn, Nick, about the flood narrative when secular people came along? How did they interpret it, or did they just dismiss it?
Well, after these events in the 1800s, they tried to dismiss it. It was considered a myth. Materialism was the new view in vogue. And so if there's an account in Genesis of the flood, well, it was borrowed from a myth from some other culture in the Near East. Maybe there was a local flood, and there are several arguments. Maybe the Black Sea flood is the source of flood stories. Some have even said that it was just a local flood, and tribes around the world, they just remember a local flood. And these are the false narratives that Paul tells us in 2 Corinthians 10. We are destroying strongholds and refuting falsehood and bringing every thought captive to the knowledge of Jesus. We have answered these arguments at length. We can discuss a few of them if you like. The only view that will account for the data is that the Genesis flood is true.
There's so much you could talk about. Now, what you don't know is that I know that in the future, I'm going to make a film about the flood. I've had that in my heart. I felt a sense that God very clearly made that clear to me. And I've been waiting. So what's joyful for me is I see the work that you've done as part of that testimony. There's more that's coming, but I'm looking forward to delving into it. That's why, for me, this is impactful. And give me a number. How many flood stories? Just give us a clue, the audience. How many narratives? And you probably haven't found them all, but how many have you found in certain areas?
Please stay tuned for this important discussion. And as always, keep thinking.